This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. The theme, new evidence of human activity fueling climate change and what we can do about it. My guest, Dr. Guy McPherson. Guy is up in Vermont, and for those of you who have not heard him on previous broadcasts, Nature Bats Last on Progressive Radio Network, read his books. Guy McPherson is a professor emeritus of natural resources, ecology, and evolutionary biology, University of Arizona. And you might hear the word emeritus here and there with different people. That's one of the highest distinctions that is made in someone who's achieved exemplary performance insights. They're considered amongst the wisest within any institution. So he has a lot of knowledge, and he has been given a lot of respect. He specialized in forest resources, energy decline, and climate change, and its economic consequences. In the past, he's also taught at Texas A&M University, University of California, Berkeley. But today, he offers us some clarion calls. He willingly walked away from a tenured professorship, full professor, by the way, for ethical reasons of conscience. He's the author of, also written with Carolyn Baker, Extension Dialogues, How to Live and with Death in Mind. And his website is guymcpherson.com. Nice to have you with us today, Guy.
Thank you, Gary. It's a pleasure to chat with you today.
We did a presentation. We filmed you in our studio in New York about 3 years ago. At that time, you made some specific predictions. Before that, in the preceding couple of years, you had also made predictions. You were very concerned that the American public were not fully aware of the consequences of not changing. And so you laid out your view of likely outcomes, outcomes such as the heat being so hot in the northern plains that a lot of the commonly grown grains would not flourish, that the Atlantic was slowing down its conveyor system, which could be really serious for much of Europe, especially northern Europe, and that the polar ice caps were melting. And you felt that we were coming close to that day when there would be no ice, at least during the summer, for the sun to reflect back into the solar system. Instead, it's going to go right through and hit the bottom of the shallow North Seas in the Arctic Circle, and that would release methane gas in the catharates, causing a crescendoing effect, since methane is far more powerful as an enhancement to global warming than carbon dioxide. And you gave a lot of different areas, mainly of all the immigrants that we're going to have, the refugees from climate disasters. Unfortunately, from then till now, the American public has done absolutely positively nothing to change. State governments, local governments, national government, nothing. They wrap their psyche in the idea of, well, we're doing something because we've watched Greta Thunberg and we're aware. Well, I don't care how aware you are. What are you doing and what can be done? And so your statements have been extremely prophetic. In fact, of all the people in the environmental movement, yours is probably were the most dire in your statements, but the most accurate in the outcome, setting aside whatever the actual timetable may be. So please, right now, uninterrupted for this audience, give us your larger worldview of what is happening and what is likely to happen and what the consequences are likely to be for someone who says, yeah, I'm interested in climate change, but I'm not going to do anything about it. And a message for that person in particular, the forum is yours.
Thank you, Gary, for that very affirmative introduction. I think the most important factor involved with climate change or planetary change in general is the forthcoming loss of ice on the Arctic Ocean. That floating ice will not significantly contribute to sea level rise when it melts because it's like an ice cube floating in a glass of water. However, the albedo or reflectance associated with that ice is profound. We have already lost a vast majority of the ice in the Arctic Ocean since we began taking measurements via satellite in 1979. And in fact, we've lost more than 99% of the old ice, the old thick ice that accumulates over multiple years. What we're left with is almost exclusively the ice from the previous year, and we keep hanging on from one year to the next. But at some point, that's going to go away. I'm actually surprised that it hasn't happened already. The projection from the Annual Review of Earth and Planetary Sciences in a 2012 paper indicated that the ice would be gone in 2016, plus or minus 3 years. Well, that takes us till 2019, and we survived that, and we survived 2020 with ice still in the Arctic, and it appears that we'll survive 2021 with ice on the Arctic. That said, there have been some recent warnings that I think bear mentioning. James Anderson, the Harvard atmospheric scientist famous for discovering the link between chlorofluorocarbons and the Antarctic ozone hole, said, quote, "The chance there will be permanent ice in the Arctic after 2022 is essentially zero," end quote. This was in an interview with Forbes on January 15th, 2018, so nearly 3.5 years ago. Actually, more than 3.5 years ago. Following up, about 3.5 years later, in CBS News on April 23rd, 2021, so just not very many months ago, Jennifer McKinnon from the Scripps Institution and also from the University of California, San Diego, says she expects an ice-free Arctic in 2022. That's next year. I think it's clear that we will not have an ice-free Arctic this year. We might very well have an ice-free Arctic next year or the following year, and the year after that is when the cascading impacts of that loss of albedo will almost certainly remove habitat for humans and most other animals on Earth. That will result, because of the very rapid rate of change to which organisms, almost no organisms, can adapt quickly enough. So I think there is one thing that we can do. There's one large-scale framework that we can employ, and that is the one created by Dr. Ye Tao at Harvard University's Rowland Institute. It's called the Mirror Reflection Framework, and you can find it at mirrorreflection.com, but in this case, mirror is spelled M-E-E-R. mereerreflection.com. And that will, in multi-talented engineer Dr. Tao's opinion, and also in mine, that will reflect, that will begin the process of reflecting incoming sunlight back out into space before we further warm the planet. That looks to me like the best case scenario that we face, but so far, in working with Dr. Tao over the course of the last 3 years or so, we haven't generated much interest in the idea. Even though it would not take a huge amount of money, it would take a huge amount of money from the perspective of you and me, but it would not take a huge amount of money with respect to federal governments, with respect to a few billionaires on the planet, and so on. So I think that's the positive way through this, is to employ the mere reflection framework. Unfortunately, it would require some sacrifices on the part of almost everybody, changes in the way we live, and I suspect most Americans are not interested in such an approach, and certainly those Americans and other people on planet Earth who have accumulated enormous privilege and seem unwilling to give up much of that privilege merely to save habitat for our own species, sadly.
Okay. Now let's try to be specific, because the more specific we are of how this will actually impact people, depending upon where they live, might be able to get some people to realize, wow, I didn't realize that the tsunami was that close to where I'm sitting. We now know in the United States, it's no longer conjecture, it's no longer maybe, it's happening right now as we speak and has been, is that at least 20 states in the United States are in drought, and some of this drought will outlast anyone living on the planet today, and maybe for several generations thereafter. Also, we don't have enough water. There's not enough water in Lake Mead, which was behind the Hoover Dam, and is at the lowest point ever to fulfill 40 million Americans living in the West. We also are not slowing our water usage in Phoenix. More people are moving to places that are not sustainable. This was a really interesting phenomenon. Why would you move to woods when there's fires, the ocean when there's oceans rising? And it makes no sense from a practical point of view, but we're not dealing in practical thought now. We're dealing in a whole nation in the grip of a cognitive disconnect. We're agreeing that we're now seeing weather patterns that we've never seen. Just this latest hurricane, normally, as you know, when a hurricane hits land, it substantially reduces from category that it's at to one of probably a tropical storm a couple hundred miles in. Not this one. This one continued to carry winds and devastating rain, and we saw the outcome. For the first time in Tennessee's history, they had all these people drowned because of flash floods. So we're seeing never-before events. In Sicily, the hottest day in recorded history of Sicily, 119.5 degrees, or about 46 degrees Celsius. We also saw the largest fire in the world, so large that all the other fires in the Amazon and all over the United States and Turkey combined didn't come close to this fire, and yet nothing in American media about it, nothing at all. We searched everywhere. It was as if it didn't exist because it was in Siberia and the northern steppes in Russia. So that's the new norm. So when we look at drought, flooding, higher hurricanes, slower moving, greater water bombs collecting, and then what this is doing to crops, farmers, it would be in everyone's interest if we just stopped for a moment, stopped all the politicizing and propagandizing, and just say, what are we doing? So could you take us now on a more intimate journey of where people live? We'll start with the United States and Canada, but then move around the world wherever you feel comfortable talking about what is going to be happening that is not reversible, so they had better be aware that what's coming at them.
Absolutely. And so, starting in the United States and Canada, primarily with the continental United States, we are already witnessing the decline of crop harvests, and particularly grain harvests. So, I met with a friend yesterday. She has driven across the country three times in the last couple of months, trying to find her place in the world. And she noticed when she was coming back this time, she just arrived back into Vermont a couple of days ago after driving from Southern California, and she noticed that the corn was burnt. Every place she drove through, and she drove through Nebraska and Iowa, the corn was burnt on the stalk. It looked like there was going to be a significantly lower harvest than there has been in previous years. The implications for that are profound. It's the grains that maintain this set of living arrangements. Whether you or I eat those grains or not, the wheat and the corn and the soybeans, and I know that soybean is not technically a grain from a botanist perspective, but it is from an economic perspective. So when those things start to decline, we're in real trouble. Every civilization so far has been maintained by the ability to produce, store, and distribute grains at a large scale. Our civilization is no different. We tend to think of it as industrial civilization, powered by fossil fuels. And yes, that's true, but it's also powered by the ability to grow, store, and distribute grains at a large scale. If those grains are declining, then we're in real trouble, because the reduction in industrial activity almost certain to result from a reduction in grains on the shelves of the stores is going to trigger the aerosol masking effect. The aerosol masking effect is something that relatively few people know about, and yet it's been the subject of more than two dozen peer-reviewed papers dating back to 1929. The most recent of those papers was published June 15th, 2021, so just a couple of months ago. It was published in Nature Communications by Gia and colleagues, and it's called Significant Underestimation of Radiative Forcing by Aerosol Cloud Interactions Derived from Satellite-Based Methods. And the bottom line here is that if we lose that aerosol masking, then we will witness an increase in planetary heating by 55% over the heating that has occurred so far, and 133% over land. Well, most of us live on land, obviously, and so that should be a cause for considerable concern. And that probably is one of the factors driving the reduction in grain production that appears to be happening this year. Okay, so that's grains. Grains affect everybody. For a long time, the United States has been an exporter of grains. I don't think there's enough grain in the world for the United States to become an importer of grains. I think we have to grow our own and continue to supply other countries in the world with food, or we just are not going to make it through this mess. Okay. Grains, therefore, I think are critically important, and the growing of grains in the United States and southern Canada is critically important to maintaining this set of living arrangements. What about elsewhere? Well, I lived in Belize in Central America for about 2.5 years, and the ability to grow food there was already profoundly declining when I exited in, was that September or October of 2018. And one of the factors driving the migration crisis on the southern border of the United States is the inability to grow food in those places where individuals and families used to grow a significant proportion of their own food. The families would get together and plant the corn, plant the vegetables that they would be eating, grow them, and that's what sustained them. It was a classic example of anarchism at the individual level, taking responsibility for yourself, recognizing that the government is not going to do it for you. So the immigration crisis that afflicts our southern border and many places in Western Europe as well is driven at least in part by the difficulty to grow food from people who have been growing food literally for generations. I was on a speaking tour in Western Europe in 2015, so in the spring, so 6.5 years ago. And the Western Europeans, who I have always thought of as being very tolerant and appreciative with respect to multiculturalism, were significantly annoyed by the number of Northern Africans and Middle Eastern people trying to illegally establish a foothold into Europe because they too were unable to grow food. This was 6.5 years ago. They were unable to grow food in places that had been growing food for their family for generations. So that's problematic. The intrusion of salt water into the freshwater table in places like southern Florida in the United States is already causing a reduction in clean water and a significant increase in the cost of cleaning that water. Obviously, hurricanes are rampant now, and it seems that the corporate media focuses on each one as if there's never been a hurricane before. If there's a new hurricane and it's a big hurricane, the comparisons are virtually lacking. And suddenly, for the more corporate media, it seems like this is the one, this is the big one. We're seeing mega droughts in the western United States, the kinds of things that haven't happened for some 1,200 years, that when we previously had a mega drought in that region, drove to extirpation or extinction several cultures. We're seeing fires, as you mentioned, all over the planet, not just in the western United States, but many other places. You know, Steve Wozniak had been following my work for a few years when I gave my first presentation in which I overtly spoke about the potential for human extinction. And he decided within a month, according to the email message he sent me, to move to the Southern Hemisphere. And it wasn't long after that before he moved to Tasmania, the southern island state of Australia. And within the last 3 years, during two of those years, the forests in Tasmania caught fire. Now, these are rainforests. These are not the kinds of fires that occur periodically in the western United States, as they did historically in the western United States. These are the kind of fires that happen every 1,000 years or so, except now it's every few years. So there are these fires. There's the extinction of more than 200 species a day. There's the ongoing pandemic that most people think has somehow magically disappeared. But while most people are familiar with the Delta variant, there's also the Iota variant, IOTA, and the Mu variant, MU, and undoubtedly others to come. Those are having significant impacts on industrial activity right now and the ability of people to actually survive. And yet it seems to be poo-pooed away by the corporate media as if it's something that we're finished with now. We're done with that pandemic. We can get on with our lives. I don't think that's the case at all. And so there's the interactions between all these factors as well. The COVID-19 and its many variants are driving reductions in industrial activity, which is causing, at least locally, as reported in the peer-reviewed literature, increases in temperature locally and regionally. And fortunately, that hasn't triggered global increases in temperature just yet. And the best we can do is wish that doesn't happen and try to make some positive steps with respect to climate change and the way we live. Thank you for giving me the time, Gary. I really appreciate the ability to speak at length in response to your questions.
You're the person who has the knowledge. We need this knowledge. I know how frustrating it is that at different parts of the story, you're in a classroom with no one listening. And then when the people come saying, we didn't realize it would be this bad. Now our house is burned down. Our house is flooded. We don't have a job. We don't, you know, we can't turn on a faucet and get water. Now we got their attention. As I've said for years, when my own listeners say, Gary, why aren't we changing? Why do we still have a two-party system, both corrupt? Why do we still feed our children junk food when we're smarter than that? I said, it's not about how smart you are. So don't use the concept of stupid and smart, because all of our policymakers, with few exceptions, are highly educated. Look at all the think tanks, from the Business Roundtable and the global research groups. Look at the Council on Foreign Relations. Look at Bilderberg. These are not illiterate individuals. They're highly informed. They're fully aware. They're as aware as most people, but they choose, instead of correcting the problem, to compound it. For example, if you're one of the people like I and many others who didn't want to see us in Afghanistan to begin with, or for that matter, I didn't want us in, I was writing commentaries against the Vietnam War. None of these wars have been to our benefit, always to our detriment, but they sure are a benefit to the military-industrial complex. All of our spying all the time, that sure is a benefit to the thousands upon thousands of firms that have managed to come up with technology that shows the government or its different agencies, we can spy on anyone at any time, no matter where they're at. If they're in a car, we can know the conversation they're having. Wherever they've been, we can track them. So the very people who can say, don't worry about climate change, we'll come up with a technological solution, are the very people who, because of the technologies, have put us in no small measure into this position. Factory farming, that's one of their technology. Who's big in that? Bill Gates, largest owner of private farmland in the United States. What is his solution to farming? Collectivize all the farms and make mega farms using genetically engineered crops and, of course, glyphosate and other synthetic pesticides. That's not a solution. Or grow in a laboratory some mystery meat that's genetically engineered, but never tested for health and safety on humans because it's a food. It's not a drug. So the very people that we're all looking at, or most people are looking at, have been, these people have their own agenda, and it's not about saving the planet. They have enough money that they can fly and have homes all over the world. They can have food grown just for them. There's always food being grown somewhere, and it doesn't matter whether the local people can eat it or not. If someone has a market price value for something, someone will buy it, someone will sell it to them, irrespective of how many hungry people there are where that food is grown. In the United States, we now have the latest figures as 36 million food insecure people. That means 36 million Americans go to bed hungry. Not a march, not a demonstration, not an article, not a documentary, nothing. It's like they're invisible. But what if that were 36 billionaires? Not 36 million, 36 billionaires and their families who were now food insecure. Do you think that wouldn't be featured in every media? But then we trust the media. And look at how the media has trashed people who have had the truth. Julian Assange, trash. Snowden, trashed. Chelsea Manning, trashed. Julian Assange, trashed. And look at all the people trying to interview people like Guy McPherson today and others to tell them the truth. Chris Hedges, trashed. Glenn Greenwald, trashed. Matt Taibbi, trashed. Max Blumenthal, trashed. Abby Martin, trashed. Naomi Wolf, trashed. And censored, deplatformed. So how in the world will we make any positive changes, be honest about the consequences, when the very people who are the policy makers implement the laws and control the levers of government, and the media that expresses these to the public, in effect propagandizes, and scientists and physicians for hire who do not have the conscious awareness that Guy McPherson did when he quit a tenured position out of conscious thought, then what is the average person to do? But they're going to be captive to propaganda saying everything's okay, don't worry, just like with COVID. Stay at home, quarantine until you're near death, then go in and get on a ventilator. We could have saved millions of people's lives worldwide had we used ivermectin, hydroxychloroquine, monoclonal antibodies, vitamin D, C. We chose not to. Not we chose. It was chosen for us by those who control the narrative. So, what is the number one narrative in the world today for the leading top five nations? Let's call those nations the three top. China, the United States, and India. They're the three major polluters in the world. And all of their carbon dioxide levels went up from over 3% to nearly 4% in the last 12 months. And China's on a rip. It is not going to slow down its polluting. It's going to increase it exponentially because it's got almost 80 countries that is giving trillions of dollars collectively to build the new Silk Road, connecting all this that will be manufacturing on the ocean pathways and on the land pathways for all these countries to benefit. Well, that means a massive amount of pollution over the next 5 years. Now look at the United States. The very people who will go out and listen to Greta Thunberg will not realize that the cell phone they're using is being, the minerals for that, including cobalt, is being mined in the Congo and Niger and other countries where slave labor is used, people are exploited, they have very short lives, yet someone is using a cell phone, eating a hamburger, and wearing jeans that they didn't need to have that cotton grown in Arizona, where you use a lot of water for cotton, without any consciousness of where things come from or what the responsibility is. So I, at this moment, for the first time in my career, I see that there's two answers. I'd like for you to address these, if you would please, Guy. One is that for probably 90% of the population, there's going to be no room in the boat. Whatever happens, it will be in part because they chose not to become politically or activist oriented and do something to change their own life and collectively cause other things to change to slow down our economy instead of growing it for Wall Street and the economic parasites. But I do see 10% of the American population awake now, not woke, but awakening to what can be done. They begin to change, then they collectively start to look at where can we put our energy to make a difference. So it is both optimistic for the 10%, which is no small number. It's still around 35 million people, but it's absolutely, it's going to be, are we there yet? And the there is, are we at a point of no return where there are few options left for the average person? And I believe that that will come within the next 5 years. I hope I'm wrong. What do you think? Please give me your opinion.
Well, I think the primary thing you and I can continue to do is to educate people so that they recognize the implications of their individual and collective actions. If we can convince 10% of the populace to profoundly change their lives, then I think that will be a tremendous win, potentially leading to the fewer than 10% of the American public who thought the Vietnam War was a bad idea, and ultimately leading to our extraction, albeit far too late, from the Vietnam War. It was those same fewer than 10% of the people that ultimately accelerated, snowballed into significant number of people who thought that environmental protection was a good idea, and led to such laws signed by very conservative people such as Richard Nixon, signing of the Endangered Species Act, of the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, and so on. So much of that legislation was passed with activism by the same folks who were acting out against our involvement in Vietnam. And then the third factor, there's the anti-war factions, same group of people that were protesting for environmental protection. They were also protesting for and taking action on behalf of social justice. It wasn't just Rosa Parks sitting in the bus. It was a whole bunch of people who came together and, against seemingly impossible odds, changed the nature of this country. The Cultural Revolution of the 1960s and early 1970s in this country changed the nature of the way we live. Now, you could argue, convincingly, I believe, that we've turned our back on all that and traded in all of those advantages, all of that anti-war, pro-environment, pro-social justice language, we've traded all that in for a few dollars more for the sake of economic growth. That is the mantra of the two primary parties in the political parties in the United States, what I call the twin cheeks of the corporate ass. The two parties who are pushing always for growth, for more money funneling through the system, because that's how they get their 1%. That's how they become the 1% or the 0.1%, is by all that money flowing through the system. What can we do? We can take the same kinds of actions that people were taking, and it was costing them their lives and their reputations in the 1960s and early 1970s. We can do that, recognizing that it will be expensive for us, recognizing that we may not be able to change anything at this point, but taking that action anyway. This is consistent with the Buddhist philosophy of taking right action and not being attached to the outcome. It's what I've been doing for more than a dozen years since I left active service at a major university on May 1st, 2009. There are many things that we can do that will improve the lives of the people near us, and that might improve the entire society. We can't know about that. Surely all those people who were protesting, the many, many people who were protesting the Vietnam War and who were taking action on behalf of social justice, surely they were disappointed for most of the time. Surely they didn't think that their actions would matter. And of course, many of them died before they saw positive change. That'll be the same with us. Many of us will die before we see positive changes, and that's no reason to stop. That's no reason to not take action that will benefit ultimately the entire society. And in the near term, those of us in our personal lives, in our communities.
Okay. We're going to go from a more philosophical perspective to one of looking around the world. You mentioned all of the refugees flooding into Europe. But now just go down through there. Spain is on fire right now. Worst fires in Spain's history. Sicily had the worst fires in their history. Italy's got fires. In fact, fires in areas at this time of year you generally don't see to the degree that which we're seeing. Major fires in the Amazon. So what is the likelihood of people who are not any longer able to sustain themselves, because no country that I'm aware of has said, let's set up a system, a humane system, a caring system, a nurturing system, and allow a number of people to come in who at least will be able to participate in our culture, in our community, become a resident and a citizen of this particular country. I don't see that happening. I don't see when you allow people in that you're actually accommodating them and helping them, especially if they don't speak the language. So where are the language classes for people? And a lot of this should be done along the way so people don't have to drown in boats going across the area from North Africa and Canary Islands over to Italy or Greece. I just think it's very inhumane when we look at people who are not in our position and think ill of them instead of taking a look, what would we be like? How would we respond? What would we expect from another human being if we were in the same dire circumstances and our children hadn't eaten in 3 days? And what would be our mindset? And this is what we're facing now with at least 1 billion people. 1 billion people are food insecure, and it's growing. So give us that view from around different countries.
You know, I think empathy is the most important thing we can learn, and I think it's impossible to teach. How do you teach empathy? You can provide examples. You can put people into certain situations so that they can at least have some understanding of what other people are going through. But until you're food insecure, I'm not sure you can even understand what that means. 1 billion people, more than 1 billion people, as you pointed out, are food insecure. How do we deal with that? If a majority of the Americans are struggling every day to make the money to put the food on their own table, and along the way have been convinced by Fox News and others that everything is okay in the world and we just need to look out for ourselves. I don't know, Gary, how we get from here to there, how we get from this set of living arrangements to a food secure, decent, aware, empathetic group of human beings, not only in political positions, but in our daily lives. I don't know how we get there except by modeling appropriate behaviors. And it's only by modeling those behaviors that people are going to look and see, hey, look what that person is doing. I want to be like that. I want to take those kinds of actions, not because it gets the person in the news, more than likely gets them in jail or in some other sort of trouble. But those become our heroes because they take these actions that threaten their own privilege. And they pop out the other side and they have helped somebody. Is there anything more important in a person's life than helping somebody? If there is, I don't know what it is. The things that have brought me joy in my entire life are the things that have me providing benefit to somebody else. That's what benefits my emotional health, is when I am improving the life of somebody else. Not when I'm improving my own life materially, whatever that means, but rather when I'm taking action that directly leads to the improvement in somebody else's life. I think most of us have some understanding of that idea, and yet it's so difficult when it feels like we're battling the world just to get to work every day, just to provide enough money to put food on the table for our own families and also provide the occasional trip to Disneyland or whatever your favorite theme park is. It's a long way from the majority of Americans who right now are dropping out of the middle class and not willingly. It's a long way from here to those folks who are struggling to get by every day to noticing that there are other people in the world, not just noticing, but attempting to care for those other people in the world and improve their situations, their lots in life as well. I think that we can take positive action and maybe people will notice. We can support the kinds of organizations and social activities that improve the lives of others and hope somebody notices. With respect to abrupt climate change, I think the Mirror Reflection Project / framework is the only way out at this point. How do we get a billionaire on board? I don't know. How do we get the government on board? I don't know. I've tried everything I can possibly think of, and so far I've fallen short. I don't know how to get from here to there, but I'm not willing to throw in the towel and say, you know, we have 6 weeks or 6 months or 6 years left to live, and I'm just going to go eat, drink, and be merry for the rest of that time.
I certainly understand the frustration, but I also appreciate your concept of the Buddhist philosophy of giving without looking at the consequence or connecting to the outcome, because the moment you give only with an outcome expectation that someone will do something and it doesn't happen, you're going to stop giving because of frustration. Now let's take a look at the larger picture. I believe that when we do pay attention, we keep paying attention to one part of the problem. That's global warming. We don't see all the other things that are happening on the planet that are also of concern, and a change in one's mindset allows all of these to be addressed. When we become a shepherd of or the caretaker for those who are less, who do not have, when we can reach down and help someone off the ground who's just fallen, and that's a natural inclination, by the way. If you see someone, especially an older person who falls, people will immediately run over. They don't care what your color is. They don't care what your race or religion is or whether you're rich or poor. They care about the fact in that moment you need a hand. I just believe that we have to start doing this when it comes to the environment. Let's get some examples now. Last weekend, Bill Maher on his show talked about water, and his answer was simple. We're running out of water on the West Coast and increasing fires, so why not put up desalinization plants? He didn't mention how energy inefficient they are and how much pollution they create with the side effects. Also, he said, let's make a pipeline, and the audience roared with approval. Exactly how does that change? Well, we got plenty of rain on the East Coast, so they have more water than what they can use without understanding any of the chemistry or the engineering of water hydraulics. But because it's raining doesn't mean all that water goes into an aquifer that now replenishes it, and now you can take a pipe and run it across America. So give us some of your input of some of the things that we would think would make sense but don't, and why, and what does make sense and how we can implement them.
The ability to connect large-scale projects to individual people's lives has been the task of government since governments first formed thousands of years ago. And so far, essentially each of those governments has failed, because the increase in human population over time negates the ability to provide technological solutions to every problem that comes along. We're facing that today, not just at the level of the United States, but at the level of the world. More people than the planet can accommodate with respect to how much clean air and clean water and healthy food we can grow. What can we do? Again, we can do a lot of things individually, personally, And some of those might scale up to the level of governments. We can demand better of our elected representatives, although I've been disappointed when making those kinds of requests in my own life. You know, there's so much to be done that for most people, I suspect, it just becomes overwhelming and they end up curling up into a fetal position and hiding in their closets because there's seemingly so much out there that is so overwhelming for us as individuals. Perhaps the most important attitude we can take is that we are one. We are one, Gary. You, me, refugees from Central America, people from China who are struggling to make our iPhones, struggling to survive while making our iPhones, the forests of Vermont, the ocean of the world, we are one. And acknowledging that oneness of us all, that what hurts you hurts me, that what stymies the potential immigrant from getting into a better place because of the actions that I take, acknowledging, recognizing, accommodating those little bits of understanding, I believe are the way we go forward. That's how we get from Martin Luther King to millions of people echoing Martin Luther King's message. That's how we get from John Kennedy and Robert Kennedy and the positive influence they provided on American society to an entire society providing those same sorts of positive messages and positive actions. Is there world enough and time? We'll never know. We'll never know if we don't take the actions, and probably we won't know if we do take the actions, but at some point, if we do take the actions and we influence enough people so that they take positive action as well, then maybe we'll get through this. Maybe. And that's enough of a chance for me to want to move forward in a positive manner, to keep spreading the message that what we do actually matters, not just to the individual people in our families that we interact with every day in our communities, but also at the level of society. How could we proceed any other way? I can't imagine just saying, well, I gave it a good shot. I'm done now. And moving on and curling up into the fetal position in my own closet. That's not for me.
Okay, let me share five ideas with you, positive ideas, positive solutions. And I've looked at the science behind these, and I believe they will make a difference. One is to stop all the logging, or at least reduce the logging, especially in the Amazon, and put pressure on Bolsonaro, the president. He's a totally off-center person, and he's comes from this purely free market mindset. And, of course, all the corruption that goes with that. So if we, all around the world, if we start asking governments, stop opening up your national forest, protect them from exploitation, that's an important first step. Second is that we can start growing trees or even growing hemp and growing other types of plants that are actual carbon sinks. And there's a whole lot of science now on what to plant that can grow quickly and also absorb carbon dioxide. Billions of plants could be implemented on a yearly basis worldwide if we made a Marshall Plan to plant trees and other shrubs, etc. Then we could all go on a reduced or meatless diet, a vegan diet. That is an enormous contributor to methane gas pollution from the animals, and also it helps protect the sentient beings from slaughter of the animals. In the process, also try to localize your food needs as much as possible, because the closer to home that you buy something that is grown and hopefully organically grown and nurturing the soil, that means that you're reducing your carbon footprint, and that means you're going to be healthier, less disease. also just stop buying all the stuff that we don't need. We don't need three cars and a family and everything else that people buy that contributes to continuing to feed the carbon-intense industries. So just look at what you can live with by having a higher quality of life, but a different standard of living. We don't need everything bigger and more and better. And so a more minimalist approach, where we have more time to spend with the people we love and hobbies and our pets, because we're not just out there every day trying to make a living to support an artificial standard of living that we're highly stressed about. Reduce your commute time. I think one of the best things that could happen is people working from home. That saves a lot of commute, which saves a lot of pollution. I also believe that we should start supporting those groups that actually contribute something positive, where all the money you give them doesn't go into administrative fees. So all they do is take your money, and maybe if you're lucky, 3-5% goes out to help the public, but the rest of it doesn't. So look carefully at where groups spend their money, especially those involved in helping people. And I also believe that we should go into countries that are going through a crisis and likely to be staying in a crisis for a while, whether it's Belize or Ecuador or, you know, Dominican Republic, any of these countries around Central and South America and North America, and see what can we do there to help people before they leave. Is there anything we can do to help that government, help its people? Because a lot of this has been due not just to climate change by itself, but by poor management systems, corrupt politicians, and cronyism. And so if we can see that projects actually get done with some form of overseer rapporteur, that would be good. So those are just some of the ideas. And then look for small communities that are ecologically minded, vegan, where they're there to enhance what they can in the balance of nature, not to deplete it. And there are 1,000 or more of these intentional communities right now in the United States alone. And in every country I travel to, you have intentional communities. They're generally almost never talked about. They could be as small as 10 people and as large as 50 or 100 people. But these are people that are getting out of the urban centers and seeking a different path in life. They're repurposing their life. Those are some of my thoughts. I'd like to hear some of yours.
Well, I couldn't agree more. What you're calling for is a stronger network of individuals within our personal lives. And I think pointing towards degrowth, not just reduced human population, but degrowth with respect to the economy. Logging the Amazon reminds me of something a friend of mine said. Amazon is thriving as the Amazon burns. As we destroy the lungs of the planet, one of the two lungs of the planet, along with the coral reefs and the oceans, as we are destroying the Amazon rainforest, we are promoting the growth of what has become an organization, Amazon, that is bigger than many countries. With respect to carbon sinks, absolutely. So you point to several pragmatic things that we can do in our own individual lives, and by doing those, hopefully influencing the people around us so that they make changes as well. And at the same time, we must do something about governments. We must do something about Amazon burning as Amazon grows. These kinds of things are imperative and have been called for my entire life. And here we are with more than twice as many people on the planet as when I was born. And still, the notion that economic growth is the most important factor in any of our lives persists. That idea lives on, that's what we can do is to grow the economy, that the rising tide floats all boats. This, of course, is nonsense. And we now know that this is nonsense. How do we get from here to there? Good leadership, electing good leadership, taking action as individuals and hoping those actions spread, acknowledging that we are one at every level, I know you recognize the frustration in my voice and my responses.
No, that's fine. Guy, we're out of time. Thank you very much for your deep insights. It's always appreciated, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Thank you, Gary, as do I.
Professor Guy McPherson, Professor Emeritus, Natural Resources Ecology and Environmental Biology, University of Arizona, at website guymcpherson.com. I'm Gary Knoll. Thank you for listening. Have a nice day. Thanks, Guy. Great interview. You really hit it.
Thank you, Gary. I appreciate the opportunity to talk to you each and every time. I'm so frustrated by what's going on in this country and in this world. And I know you feel it, too.
I do. But we have to look at the solutions. We can't look at the problem by itself. Otherwise, we become disillusioned. Look forward to our next call. Thank you.
Thank you. Take care.